Big picture stuff on the program today. Big banks and big pharma with big problems on Capitol Hill. Some politics, too. Big trade, specifically from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdoff. Friday, the 23rd of September. Glad to have you along, everybody. Also along to spend 4.5 minutes of live radio reviewing the past 5 days in the American economy. Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Felix Salmon is from Fusion. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Lynette, we start with you, and we start on Capitol Hill, the Congress of the United States, and two CEOs who had a rough week up there.
So busy this week.
So busy.
Wow.
So which one do you want to start with? Do you want to start with John Stumpf at
Wells Fargo
or Heather Bresch at Mylan, the EpiPen person? You pick.
Let's start with EpiPen
because I'm
the most incensed about that.
So she was
one,
up there
actually.
Yesterday. Let's remind everybody, this is the life-saving injector that used to cost $100 10, 15 years ago, now costs $600. Begin.
Now, this is what really upset me about the Mylan thing. There are two parts.
Yes.
One, Bresch would not admit that they raised the price of the drug in order to make more money. She just kept saying, we raised the price of the drug to increase access to patients. And everyone was like, please, this is stupefying. Stop. Hmm. And then the other thing that she did was she claimed that her company had saved the U.S. $180 billion.
Oh, wow.
And so I reached out to their PR and was like, well, how is that possible? And their explanation was that a government report had said that generic drugs had, you know, saved the U.S. whatever trillion dollars from 05 to 2014. And since Mylan was 11% of that market, generic drug market, they were claiming 11% of that number, which is hilarious. That's like, you know, that's like Toyota Camry, you know, Toyota claiming that it's saving America money because people buy Camrys instead of Lamborghinis. It's just silly.
Felix, we're...
So it's a lot going on.
Felix, you get John Stumpf and Wells Fargo, who was up there in front of the Senate Banking Committee on Monday or Tuesday, given a very rough time by a whole lot of people on that committee.
Especially Elizabeth Warren, who was at her finest.
She went viral.
She was in Fuego. She's a lawyer. She knew just how to, you know, attack him on multiple fronts, and all he could do is just sit there and take it. But frankly, that's the worst that is going to happen to him. You mustn't feel sorry for him, because all of what she was calling for, including his criminal prosecution, is not going to happen. So he gets to smugly sort of sit there and say, oh, well, I had a rough time at the hands of Elizabeth Warren for a morning, and then I get to walk home with another $20 million. I'll take it. And
also, he got to get away with forgetting everything. He forgot everything.
But more to the point, saying that there's nothing wrong with that bank's culture when 5,300 people got fired for doing the cross-selling and opening bank accounts.
Yeah, after the first couple of thousand people, you'd think you'd start questioning your culture.
That's true. There's, you know, something there.
A different story, sort of corporate-y in the news today, Felix. This rumored sale of Twitter, do you care?
Oh, I do.
Do you?
Yes.
Oh, all right.
Have you seen this man's Twitter feed?
Yes, I have.
I kind of want Twitter to be bought by someone else.
So it lives, so it survives.
So that it's no longer a publicly traded company with a huge amount of pressure on it to show earnings growth and user growth and revenue growth, so that it can become the public utility that it has always been without a bunch of public company pressure. I love the idea that it can just be a bit of Google or a bit of Salesforce doing what it does really well without having to be a bunch of things that it's not.
Lynette, I'm going to guess you agree with him. Yeah.
I love Twitter. I'm a journalist. I understand that a lot of people don't use it.
Right.
We'll see what happens. And hopefully, you know, I get to keep uploading pictures of me and Felix looking silly in the studio for all of
every
our
Friday.
Listeners.
We count on them. I'm contractually obliged here to mention Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve. Not raising interest rates
for the time being.
Felix, you
for
have
time being,
8
yes.
seconds to make your point. Go.
So that basically means until after the election.
Okay.
And then it's conceivable that there will be one rate hike this year, but I'm not holding my breath.
And nor am I. Lynette, your thoughts?
I mean, it's Janet. It's Janet. She's just going to keep doing her thing.
Right.
I'm waiting for the data. I'm waiting for it to be interesting.
I'm
waiting for people to stop expecting me to talk about this.
November 1st and 2nd are off the table, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right. So look at that. We did the Fed in like 42 seconds. I'm pretty proud of myself.
Well done, Kai.
Thank you very much. Felix Salmon from Fusion. I was about to say Reuters. From Fusion. And Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Have a good weekend, all right?
You too.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. We'll see you. Traders threw in the towel early today. Details, numbers. You know the drill. I'm still waiting for my email telling me my Yahoo account's been hacked. Fingers crossed I'm not one of the unlucky 500 million people whose accounts were. The company posted an FAQ yesterday covering the basics of its ginormous hack, what kinds of information the hacker stole, what Yahoo users uttered you next, and then a whole bunch of information about passwords, stuff like hashed passwords and hashed passwords in bcrypt and unprotected passwords and all kinds of stuff. Turns out there is a whole lot of technology that kicks in when you choose your favorite password. Gigi Duban explains it all.
There are different ways websites can store your password. So when you come back and enter that password again, they know it's you. If you walked away from that FAQ wondering what the heck hashing, bcrypt, and salting mean, here you go. Hashing is a tight form of encryption. So if you have like a secret conversion code, say A equals 1, B equals 2...
You secure the data in a way that somebody can't just steal your, if you will, your conversion table and suddenly reverse engineer all the data.
Fred Kate teaches cybersecurity at Indiana University. He says hashing data is just a way to obscure what it says. Bcrypt is a type of hashing. Think of it as the next level of security. It basically converts the data to something random again and again. The next level is salting.
And salting is where, as part of the encryption process, you add other irrelevant data.
It's jumbling up stuff even more, which is good for when people use common words in their passwords. The downside?
It's computationally resource intensive, is the way we would put it.
In other words, this makes your computer's head hurt, and it might take it a little longer. Kate says Yahoo wants security, but it also doesn't want to frustrate its users by having them wait every time they sign in. But not everyone's password gets this level of security. Yahoo says it uses bcrypt on the vast majority of hashed passwords. Amber Steele is with LastPass, a password manager.
Now, even if only 5 or 10% haven't been, I mean, that's still a huge number when you're talking about 500 million accounts being affected.
I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Facebook admitted today and apologized for having miscalculated and overstated some important numbers for advertisers and media companies past couple of years. Numbers about the average time that Facebook users spend watching videos. In its record keeping, the company only counted videos, it seems, that were watched for more than 3 seconds. Bail on a video before that, it's like it never happened. It seems small, but if you're counting on Facebook videos to make money, as more and more companies are, oh, it matters. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
Earlier this year, the Tex-Mex restaurant Chuy's advertised this video on Facebook.
That is delicious.
The clear winner here is Chuy's.
Actually, Chuy's did seem like a winner. The average view for that video is 100%.
I don't think it's mathematically, you know, possible.
Kristen Sussman is president of Social Distillery, a social media agency that helped Chuy's with that Facebook ad.
Now, reading the news, I'm pretty confident that this must have been an outcome of inaccurate reporting.
Mistakes like this breed mistrust, says Gary Wilcox, a social media and advertising professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He says advertisers misjudge how they're doing and think,
geez, if that's working, let's throw some more money at that and see if we can keep up that success.
Many advertisers have been calling on third-party firms to step in and double-check numbers. Otherwise, they say it's like Facebook is marking its own homework. Not all advertisers, especially the big ones, are too burned by Facebook's missteps, says Sam Rosen, vice president of market intelligence firm ABI.
Some advertisers are in a very data-rich environment already because they're able to measure the follow-through of customers directly through their e-commerce platforms.
Paul Verna, a media analyst with eMarketer, says as for Facebook...
Well, the market seems to be shrugging this off, so I don't think it's a body blow, but it's definitely a black eye.
And he says advertisers won't shy away because Facebook is, well, it's Facebook. I'm Rima Kreese for Marketplace.
Kind of wait and see for both opponents and supporters of the Dakota Access Pipeline, the big project that's designed to move hundreds of thousands of barrels of crude oil every day from wellheads in North Dakota to refineries in Illinois. Native American tribes are and have been protesting, fearing danger to their water supply and to culturally important sites. They have gotten a temporary injunction. More hearings are coming. But Marketplace's Jed Kim reports from the Sustainability Desk that there is something else hanging over this case as well.
The pipeline would cross the Missouri River just above the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Leaders of the tribe aren't just waiting around for court decisions. I caught Chairman Dave Archambault between meetings in Washington, D.C.
It's time that Indigenous people's rights are recognized.
Not just the rights of his people.
I've been visiting with tribes from Peru and from Brazil and from Ecuador and from Quebec. And every one of them has a story.
Stories of having to fight other energy projects. Indigenous groups around the world have expressed support for his tribe. He's trying to use the momentum to showcase others' plights. That momentum could face a speed bump. The Republican Party's position on energy and environmental issues.
It's energy above everything.
Daniel Fiorino directs the Center for Environmental Policy at American University.
So if that means you deregulate, if it means you use whatever authority you have to get around these local protests, you do it.
At the very least, he says, a Republican energy policy means less sympathetic ears to future protests. If that happens, we're likely to see escalation in tactics. Pamela Oliver studies crowds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
The more aggressively people try to get the law on their side to prevent public involvement, the more public involvement has to get disruptive if it's going to have any impact at all.
And she has a point. A coalition of 75 Native groups in the U.S. and Canada says it will join the fight if things escalate. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
We've got a map of where that pipeline might go if it goes anywhere. You can check it out at marketplace.org. Coming up,
globalization is here to stay, but it's gotten to an extreme to where now it's doing more harm than good.
Trade, Trump, and how that all might work out. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 131 points on this Friday, 0.7%, 18,261 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 33 points, 0.6%, 5305. The S&P 500 off 12 points, about 0.5%, 21.64. For the week, the Dow up 0.75%, the NASDAQ up 1.1%, the S&P 500 up 1.2%. Turbulence today in the tech world, we alluded to some of it. Facebook flopped 1.6%. As we told you earlier, there was that whole overstating the videos thing. Yahoo yielded 3% lower as it continued to struggle with that hack. Twitter up 22% after CNBC reported it might be sold. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. 72 hours, plus or minus, to the first presidential debate Monday night. The economy is going to be at or near the top of the list of things moderator Lester Holt is going to be asking Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton about. And if history is any guide, he's going to start his economic questioning with global trade and America's place in it. Dan D'Amico is the former chairman and chief executive of Nucor Steel. That is one of the world's biggest steel companies. He is the senior trade advisor to the Trump campaign. Mr. D'Amico, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Mr. Trump has said on more than one occasion that he wants to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and failing that, he would pull out. What do you suppose he would replace it with? Has he told you?
I think the idea here is to replace, if it was got to the point where we weren't able to renegotiate, the idea would be to replace it with another agreement that was more favorable to this country and to our workers and our domestic-based manufacturers. And no one's ever gone back and said, hey, let's renegotiate up until now because, and they should have, because it has not worked out in our favor. You've heard just recently about United Technologies moving a couple thousand jobs down there. Ford is going to move all its small car production down
so,
there.
So let me stop you right there, sir, and just on, sure. on the Ford issue, because Ford has said it's not going to lose any jobs in the United States because of that deal, and that what it's going to do actually is make higher margin trucks at the plant in Detroit where it's no longer going to make those small cars. The question, though, is what is Donald Trump going to replace NAFTA with? Because negotiations go both ways, right? And if Mr. Trump wants to be harder with Mexico, then Mexico, in theory, would say, well, no, that's not in our interest. So, again, what will Mr. Trump replace NAFTA with?
Well, first off, it will be in Mexico's best interest to renegotiate the deal. But if what you're saying is that, okay, everything goes bad, there will be no NAFTA.
And there will be then, what, 35% tariffs?
There's plenty of trade that goes on between nations that do not have trade agreements. The United States and Japan is a good example. So the issue that there has to be a NAFTA, it's not true. But that doesn't mean that Mr. Trump doesn't want to have a NAFTA. He just wants to have one that works for us as well as it works for Mexico.
Do you suppose Mr. Trump, in talking about levying 35% tariffs, as he has said he would do on the Ford products, just to get back to that example that you raised, the small cars that Ford now is going to start making in Mexico, do you suppose he understands that that 35% tariff will not be paid by Ford in the end? It will be paid by American consumers?
Well, that's not necessarily true. First off, Ford's going to be competitive. They're going to sell their cars at what it takes to sell their cars at. So I totally disagree that the idea that the American consumer is going to foot that bill.
So Ford will willingly take a 35% tariff?
Whether they willingly take it or not, all right, that would be the case. And, whether they're able to pass it along to the consumers is another matter. They've got plenty of competition out there. Again, the goal is not to put 35% tariffs on anybody, but to get a better agreement worked out, and there are a lot of issues that need to be addressed. But just to go back to the Ford example that you mentioned a minute ago, it's great that Ford is not going to cut its workforce in the United States. But it would be even better if the small car manufacturing stayed here too. There would be even more jobs. There wouldn't be a flat job situation. It'd be an increasing job situation if those cars were not made in Mexico and they were made in the United States.
Well, sir, we are adding jobs in this economy. Every month.
We're not adding anywhere near enough jobs, as witnessed by the 1.9% average GDP growth rate over the last 10 years or more, and the 1.1% recently. So while we've created jobs, we've created low-paying jobs. And over this period of time, we've lost over 5 million high-paying manufacturing jobs and high-paying jobs that breed off of the manufacturing facilities in every community.
Do you suppose that Mr. Trump's trade policies will actually bring back high-paying manufacturing jobs to this country if companies can more economically, right? And you're a businessman and you know this. If you can make more money building your things overseas, why are you going to bring jobs back here?
That is such a great point, Kai. It's such a great point because Mr. Trump's entire economic plan, including his trade policy, are designed to increase our global competitiveness. That doesn't mean we're going to move away from globalization. There's no chance of that. Globalization is here to stay, but it's gotten to an extreme to where now it's doing more harm than good for our economy. And I'll tell you how I know that, because we have a $13 trillion accumulated trade deficit since 1990 in goods, manufactured goods. That's because we bought into a failed economic model that said somehow we could forget about being a nation that makes things and builds things and somehow be a nation that services things, and we got to get back to being a nation that makes and builds things.
So let me make sure that I understand what you're saying. You are, as Mr. Trump has said, what we want to do is get back to old-line manufacturing jobs in this country. We want to bring back the steel and the coal.
It's not old-line. O-line is your terminology. Steel industry is one of the most modern, innovative steel industries in the world. We employ all of the technology that the tech companies have developed. They include not only the 30% of the steel industry that's disappeared in this country, but the aluminum industry, the glass industry. It's not a question of bringing buggy whips back. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about bringing back current industries that are in current manufacturing that's being done around the world instead of here.
Dan DiMicco, former chairman and chief executive of Nucor Steel. He is currently a senior trade advisor to the Donald Trump campaign. Mr. DiMicco, thanks very much for your time, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Not only are the candidates preparing each in their own way for the debate on Monday, so too are their advertising teams getting ready to capitalize on what is expected to be a record audience on TV and, almost more importantly, online. You've probably seen some of their ads on Facebook and Twitter and websites, but the ads that you see, they're probably really different from, say, what the person in the next cube over is seeing, because campaigns are working real hard to get each ad to hit just the right nerve for just the right person. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that story.
This debate could have one of the biggest audiences ever in a presidential race. Some estimates say up to 100 million people will watch on Monday night, many of them tweeting and posting and chatting online at the same time. And that's where advertisers and campaigns will be spending a lot of money. Jenna Golden is head of political ad sales at Twitter. She says the debate will be a big night for Twitter traffic and targeted ads.
We're expecting that to be astronomical compared to what it was 4 years ago.
So her team is telling the campaigns to budget big, at least six figures, for Twitter ads on debate night. And keep in mind, we're not just talking about one ad shown to everyone.
You might see one ad tweaked in 15 different ways and then set up across 17 different campaigns.
Campaigns can make those tweaks because they know a lot about what potential voters do online. That's thanks to people like Brian Gernert of Resonate, a data tracking company. He says there's about 50 times as much information available as there was the last presidential election.
And we observe a huge volume of online behavior data, such as which websites people go to, what type of content they're reading, across 15 billion different data points in a day. And from that, that gives us insight into what issues and causes people are most concerned about.
Including what might get voters to swing towards one candidate or another. 21-year-old Spencer Claiborne of Kansas City, Missouri, got an early start in politics. He volunteered with the Obama campaign in 2008 when he was 12.
There's an adorable photo of me in front of a campaign poster. I can't believe I had that haircut.
Now, Claiborne leans Republican. He volunteered for Mitt Romney in the last election.
Political ads that are targeted at me tend to be now from Democratic candidates trying to appeal to the sensibility side of Republican voters.
He says he was planning to vote Republican for Missouri's Senate seat until this.
I'm Jason Kander, and Senator Blunt has been attacking me on guns.
That sound you hear is the candidate putting together a rifle. Blindfolded. It's Jason Kander, a Democrat running for the Senate in Missouri.
And in the state legislature, I supported Second Amendment rights. I also believe in background checks so that terrorists can't get their hands on one of these.
Claiborne reads conservative outlets online and follows Republicans on Twitter, both things that can be tracked. And he says the targeting works.
The fact that companies know such specific data about me and about what could change my opinions scares me. But at the same time, I'm happy that this ad for Jason Kander was targeted to me because it helped me make my decision.
The targeting worked so well, in fact, he's decided to volunteer for the campaign. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the first and last time you will hear me say the words pumpkin spice on this program this fall. Later this month, McDonald's Japan
is doling out French fries drizzled with a pumpkin spiced sauce and a chocolate sauce. You can get your own basket of pumpkin spice fries, officially known as the Halloween Choco Potato Fries, starting September 28th in Japan. Once again, no plans to sell them here in the United States because, first of all, gross. And second of all, can we stop with the pumpkin spice, please? I know there are millions of you who really like pumpkin spice. I can't. Can barely even say it, right? Today, the Dow off 131 points, the NASDAQ down 33 points, the S&P 500 down 12, but it was an up week. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer around here. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.